Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Gregory Inskip, and I represent the appellant, LaGrange Communities, LLC. On an appeal from two rulings of the Superior Court, which construed a development agreement between LaGrange and the appellee, Cornell Glasgow, that agreement concerned the construction of the LaGrange residential community off of Route 40 near Glasgow, Delaware. The agreement provided that time is of the essence as to all matters to be performed under this agreement. Section 1A of the agreement refers to, quote, time frames, close quote, in a sales projection schedule for the building and sale of homes. The first issue on appeal concerns the proper construction of the contractual language I have just mentioned in a setting in which the appellee, Cornell, failed to meet the contractual schedule for sale of single-family homes. The second issue on appeal involves the same contractual provisions. On one occasion, the appellee persuaded the court below that the contractual language established a firm schedule for Cornell to build and sell homes. Cornell thereby avoided dismissal of a claim on which it later received an award of damages. In the rulings appealed from, however, the Superior Court accepted Cornell's argument that the schedule was aspirational only, a result that I submit is precluded by the doctrine of judicial estoppel, whatever the merits of the contractual dispute. In both of these areas, contractual interpretation and judicial estoppel, the rulings of the court below are reviewed de novo by this court.
Well, in terms of the contractual interpretation, what role, if any, do the other provisions of the agreement have in making the interpretation of the contract, including provisions with actual firm deadlines as opposed to projections?
Well, Your Honor, I'll answer that two ways. First of all, I think the court is certainly correct, and we rely on the jurisprudence of this court, notably in the recent Riverbend decision, that says the contract is construed within its four corners if possible, but no one provision is taken out of context or given disproportionate importance. So if that's what Your Honor is getting at, yes, I agree, and we'll argue that the court below erred by single-minded focus on a word, projection. But to Your Honor's second point, I disagree that the sales projection schedule and other time language in the contract did not specify specific dates. Indeed, they did. The schedule attached as Exhibit A to the contract and incorporated by reference in Section 1A of the contract provides that the sales pace for construction and sales of single-family homes will begin 90 days after the building permit is obtained. From that prescription, Cornell's own damages expert, Mr. Anderson, was able to say when the first quarter of the schedule began, and indeed project that out to say how many homes Cornell was to have sold by January 26, I believe, 2011, just before the relationship between these parties came to an end. So it is not the case that there were no deadlines. It was a schedule with different dates along the way on that schedule. The schedule started at a point which was unascertained when the development agreement was signed, but objectively specified so that, again, Cornell's own expert could describe what Cornell's obligations were.
In the context of this contract and similar contracts, does the word projection constitute a form of term of art? Is there some industry meaning or industry standard that's meant by the use of that word?
There was no evidence. I think Mr. Lingo testified for Cornell as to what he thought projection meant, but there was no expert evidence that it is a term of art, Your Honor. And I would say perhaps if to get right to the meat of the argument, the decisive language in the contract is Section 1A itself. And if the court's disposed to, it can be found at page 142 of the appendix. I also quote it twice in the opening brief at pages 5 and 11, but I'll read it. Building rights. LaGrange hereby grants to Cornell the right to undertake the construction project per the time frame set forth in the sales projection schedule attached hereto and made a part hereof as Exhibit A, commencing on the date of this agreement. The first thing to note, Your Honors, is that the agreement does not use the word projection in a vacuum or by itself. It does not. It is not a sole title of the timing language. Rather, the word appears as part of a phrase, quote, sales projection schedule, close quote. This by itself, I submit, refutes the conclusion below that the undertaking was merely aspirational. Schedules are expected to be met. I mean, I was supposed to be here before 10 o'clock this morning. And even in less formal business relationships than this court proceeding, schedules are serious. They're expected to be met.
The trial court seemed to think that this use of the word projection was similar to a publicly traded corporation reporting the quarterly projection of earnings for the balance of the earnings calendar. Yeah. Is it? How do you make that analogy, or can you?
I don't think you can. And I disagree very much with the analogy. And the citation of the Oracle case, I think, is simply an apposite. And again, we don't just have a projection here. We have a projection schedule. And that, to fit those words, if there's any question about projection, what projection means, I think the word schedule should steer the court into toward the definition cited in LaGrange's brief, where in the sense of plan, it's a forward-looking plan, but just because it's forward-looking doesn't mean it's any less binding. Contractual undertakings by their nature are forward-looking. This conclusion is reinforced by the context of the phrase sales projection schedule in Section 1A. First, the sales projection schedule is described as setting forth time frames, quote unquote. Frames, again, provide structure, and the use of the word time frames contemplates firm dates. Second, Section 1A expressly links, quote, Cornell's right to undertake the construction project, close quote, to, quote, the time frame set forth in the sales projection schedule, close quote. Cornell's obligation to meet those time frames and LaGrange's rights to timely performance are the specified exchange for Cornell's rights to build homes on the property and to be compensated therefore. Cornell did not meet the time frames, so it does not have the right to continue with the project or to recover contractual compensation for homes it did not build.
Is it factually correct that the schedule wasn't met for the quarter one?
Yes.
Was there any contact between the parties to discuss why the schedule wasn't met at that point?
Your Honor, there was contact between the parties through the fall of 2010, and I do not believe I put that in the appendix or talked about it in the briefs. I talked about it in the briefs before Judge Slights. But the parties were, it is in the record, but the parties were discussing why these homes weren't selling. They were discussing new designs. And so, yes, they did have discussion over time.
Well, what do we do on appeal after a trial where the judges heard testimony from the parties about their view of the word projection, and then the judge makes a determination that this is what projection meant? It's kind of a mixed question of fact and law. Did the factual determination drive the legal determination, or was the contract so clear that the legal determination could be made without regard to the testimony?
The rationale of the rulings appealed from are different on those points, Justice Holland. The court below denied the summary judgment motion on the grounds that the word projection imported an ambiguity. The ruling after trial in the December 7 opinion was the rule is that the use of the word projection makes it unambiguous that the undertaking was aspirational only. So the court below ruled as a matter of law and did not base its ruling on extrinsic evidence.
So you're saying that the judge didn't attribute the aspirational nature to the word projection based on anyone's testimony?
I don't think he did. Cornell has, maybe he did. Mr. Lingo said that was his understanding. So that is in the record. I will say right now that the extrinsic evidence that I remember the court's opinion relying on was Cornell's use of lot purchase agreements in other transactions that had what Judge Slice thought were firmer deadlines than the agreement at issue here. But that's not extrinsic evidence of an agreement, Your Honor, because there's no evidence those were ever shared with LaGrange.
I'm just trying to make a consistent whole of what's going on. It doesn't seem inconsistent to deny summary judgment saying projection is ambiguous. We need to find out the intent of the parties, because if something's ambiguous, then you look to the intent of the parties. Then after you hear from the parties to say, I've concluded that projection in the context of this contract was aspirational. Is that what happened?
I believe Judge Slice got to the conclusion that it's aspirational by construction of the word itself. And he resorted to definitions, and you know, both from an online dictionary and from a court of chancery, I think, decision. He never locked horns with LaGrange on the definitions we cited to him and have cited again to this court. But I would submit to you that the way this court has consistently said that contracts will be interpreted is you start within the four corners of the contract. And this is whatever Judge Slice did. This is something that this court has the right and duty to do. Look at the four corners of the instrument and see if you can ascertain the meaning from that. Would in Section 1A, does LaGrange exchange rights over its land to Cornell for Cornell to build homes and make a profit thereby in exchange for an aspiration? I mean, would a reasonable party so contract or so understand the language? And would a reasonable party understand a schedule and a time frame to mean something merely aspirational when Section 19 of the same contract says, quote, time is of the essence as to all matters to be performed under this agreement? I think that's a clincher if there's any doubt about the contract itself. And if we get Justice Holland to forgive the term, liar's battle. You know, Mr. Nichols, my client, said he thought a projection meant this or this language meant this, and Mr. Lingo thought something else. I don't know where I am. I don't even remember a case that said judicial assessment of extrinsic evidence is entitled to factual deference. I mean, you certainly could make that argument. But what I'm arguing today is you don't even get there. You know, the contract within its four corners is clear. It talks about time frames as to the building schedule, and it says time is of the essence. I just don't think you can. And I will say, I don't think I have to show prejudice here, but LaGrange sunk, according to its manager, Mr. Nichols, $900,000 in installing infrastructure that it never recovered because these homes were never built. So it was hurt. It's not a frivolous post hoc point that we're talking about now.
If we were to determine that the contract is ambiguous in terms of projection and what that means, is there evidence, extrinsic evidence in the record, that would support the conclusion reached by the trial judge in this case?
I would have to say yes, Your Honor. I mean, Mr. Lingo testified that's, well, I don't know. I will say this, the course of dealing. Mr. Lingo put in an email of his from early 2009. It's in the appendix, I believe. It's discussed in the opening brief, saying that, for which he said he and Mr. Nichols thought that profitability trumped pace. And that's, Mr. Lingo did testify that way at trial. So the answer to Your Honor is, yes, I think there is some extrinsic evidence that goes to this point. But interestingly, if you look at that same email that Cornell relies on, it appended, I think, the parties two competing or two proposals, early proposals for an agreement, and this led toward the development agreement. Neither one of those, Your Honor, contains a time is of the essence provision. The development agreement does. So ultimately, in the interests of letting the parties put some secure parameters on their obligations and expectations and to supply a rule of decision to judges and justices, you begin with the four corners of the contract and you look,
Can you comment on the language of the contract that required the development to be completed within, was it 11 quarters? And if it was not, there would be a default?
Yes, that's, Judge Slights noted that language when he denied an earlier motion of LaGrange's and said that the contract did have firm deadlines. On that, in the briefing on that issue, Cornell itself argued that, quote, the language of the agreement itself, as negotiated and agreed to by the parties, clearly establishes a time frame in which the development agreement was to be complete. Exactly what I'm saying now. What morphed into aspirational times in what we're talking about now, the rulings appealed from, was asserted by Cornell to clearly prescribe a time frame for the development to be over.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at, does the projection and the 11-quarter provision counterbalancing against each other create a need for extrinsic evidence?
No, because the sales projection schedule itself, the document bearing that title, attached as Exhibit A to the agreement, incorporated and referred to in Section 1A of the agreement, is exactly what sets forth those times, starting with the first building permit for each class of home, and then it has the quarters going out until the development is complete. No, I would say, if anything, the sales projection schedule, you're projecting into the future a schedule, and here it is, and it starts when the building permits obtained for the first house of that nature, and then it goes forward mathematically. And that's how Cornell's own expert calculated it.
Thank you. I should warn you that you, maybe it's because of our questions, but you work through your rebuttal time as well.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, David Felice from Ballard Spahr on behalf of the Appellee Cornell Glasgow LLC. With me today is my colleague Chad Flores. Judge Slight's decision with respect to the meaning of the word projection must be affirmed for three reasons. First, following a five-day trial, post-trial briefing, Judge Slight's found that the ordinary and customary definition of the word projection controlled. LaGrange's attempts to re-argue the same misplaced definitions and flawed contract construction should not change Judge Slight's well-reasoned result. Second,
can you explain to me why he focused solely on the word projection and didn't put it in context, as you heard in the earlier argument?
Certainly, Your Honor. Judge Slight's focus on the word projection because he did not have to resort to extrinsic evidence in the first instance. He found that the ordinary and customary definition of projection meant aspiration or goal.
Well, I understand, but my question is, the phrase sale projection schedule, does not the word schedule add something to the word projection?
Well,
it's schedule what we're talking about, and then the descriptive words of the schedule are sales projection schedule.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's my reason for my question. Why did he take projection as a word and isolate it from the phrase and then define it?
Your Honor, I believe he did so because projection modifies schedule. Schedule doesn't modify projection. So there was no question whether schedule was ambiguous or needed to be defined. That was never an issue. The issue was, what does projection mean with respect to both paragraph 1A, the building rights provision, paragraph 19, the time is of the essence provision, and Exhibit A. So in order to get where LaGrange wants you to go, you have to construe all three of those provisions together and find that projection means a firm sales deadline. And you don't get there by looking at the word schedule, because schedule doesn't modify anything in Exhibit A. It's modified by the word projection.
So time is of the essence in this context. Your position would be, I take it, that work as fast as you can, because time is important to us, but if you can't make it within the schedule that we've set, so what?
Not at all, Your Honor. As the evidence introduced below proves, this was an endeavor to make profit, to profit as best as they could in the down economic environment, in the down housing environment. Pace didn't trump profitability. That came across throughout trial. The issue is, well, if it doesn't modify Exhibit A, then what does it modify? And what it does modify, as just Judge Slates identified below, it modifies the firm deadline financing commitments of paragraph 1A, because if they weren't able to get financing as they had under the original development agreement, the contract would be null and void. It also modifies, and what was near and dear to my client's heart, was the timing of reimbursement payments owed to Cornell under paragraph 5G. So we have other examples and other provisions in the contract where the time of the essence would still fit within the contract and modify other provisions. It just doesn't modify Exhibit A, because Exhibit A was a projection as agreed to by the parties. Looking at the first basis to reaffirm to affirm Judge Slight's opinion, Judge Slight initially said the contract is unambiguous. If I look at what the ordinary and customary definition of the word projection means, it means an aspiration or a target. Justice Steele, you questioned Mr. Inskip. Is the word projection, does it have a particular meaning within the construction industry? It doesn't. Mr. Inskip conceded that. It just means what any ordinary person would think projection means. What does that mean for purposes of this appeal? The court shouldn't put any particular gloss on the phrase. The court shouldn't look to say, well, what should it have meant in this industry? What should it have meant to these parties?
Because we're unlikely to do that because all our case law says our sole objective is to determine whether the trial court in this circumstance correctly determined the intent of the parties. It certainly has nothing to do with what we think projection might mean. We're trying to figure out what the parties intended it to mean by the use of that word in the particular phrase combined with whether or not time is of the essence modifies it in any way.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would submit that you look at the objective intent of the parties, and here the objective intent of the parties was exactly what the word says, projection. If you look at how this definition fits within the development agreement itself, it fits squarely within the four corners. As an initial matter, LaGrange has not argued and cannot argue that Judge Slight's reading of Exhibit A conflicts with the development agreement's other express provisions. They haven't made that argument. They haven't said that if it's read as a projection, something other than a hard deadline, it conflicts with another provision. That argument hasn't been made.
Okay, I want to go back to the relationship between the summary judgment ruling and the post-trial one. Did Judge Slight's rule that the term was ambiguous and that required evidence to be heard on summary judgment?
On summary judgment, in the oral ruling, that Judge Slight did suggest that Exhibit A was ambiguous. However,
is that the law of the case that should be followed at trial, or was that clearly wrong?
Well, it should not be followed because the final decision, the final opinion, Judge Slight held that the Exhibit A was unambiguous. Nonetheless, he said even if it is ambiguous, the weight of the extrinsic evidence weighs in favor of Cornell's reading.
And what is that extrinsic evidence?
The extrinsic evidence, Your Honor, is cited in our answering brief at pages 8 to 11, and Judge Slight examined some of the extrinsic evidence at pages 36 to 37 of his opinion. One example of this extrinsic evidence was when Greg Lingo, a Cornell principal, testified that he understood the endeavor to be profit-driven rather than deadline-driven. Exhibits introduced at trial these lot purchase agreements, and his own testimony described that this was not a deadline-driven endeavor. It was a profit-driven endeavor. If he had understood that this was similar to a lot purchase agreement, he said he wouldn't have entered into it.
So he would have understood if he hadn't received his payment on time, it was because the other party couldn't make a profit if they paid him on time. He would have said, fine, no problem. I don't need my distribution or my payment on time. Is that your position? Because it was profit-driven, which would mean for both parties.
Yes, Your Honor. But there's profitability and there's reimbursement. So reimbursement was when we build a home and we market these homes, when we incur those overhead expenses, you're going to pay us for them. We're going to submit them, and under 5G, after a certain period of time, I think it was 5 days, you're going to pay us. That was a firm deadline. And if you look at the contract itself, specifically under paragraph 2D, the parties understood and knew how to use the word deadline because the word deadline is used in that provision, paragraph 2D. So with regard to reimbursement costs, that was a hard deadline under 5G. With regard to the distribution of profits, that was something later on when the balance sheets were in and that was tied to after each fiscal year, they would true up, and if they made more profits, they would split them 80-20.
So one party was expected to build the infrastructure and not be reimbursed, but wait until the end of the contract to see if there was money to pay him? Or was the party who built the infrastructure expecting that based on the schedule for sales, there would be some payment at the end of each quarter to help reimburse the out-of-pocket cost?
Well, Your Honor, this is where we get into some of the factual issues of the case below. LaGrange was only supposed to improve the lots as they were taken down, and they would be taken down when they were being ready to be sold. If they were, there was a contract for sale, they'd be taken down. You'd have to pay the bank to take the property down. There would be borrowing on the line of credit, and then construction would begin. And the contract said you had 2 years to actually build the house from the time the sale contract, the sale agreement was entered. The problem is Mr. Nichols, through his own company, Nichols Excavation and Nichols Construction, would improve these lots way ahead of schedule because he would be then drawing down on the line of credit to pay himself. Now, that's a factual question that, you know, actually didn't really come up in the trial below. But to answer your question, well, why is this testimony, and there's only testimony, that there was $900,000 in arrears on LaGrange's side, where did that come from? Well, one reason is they improved these lots when there wasn't any contract for sale. So he was getting paid to improve these when no one was willing to put a house on that lot. And second, they bought this property in 2007 before the market crashed. They paid 2007 prices for this property.
Does the use of a projection contemplate that there can be, or is there evidence that it contemplated potential problems with buyers getting financing and needing to extend settlement dates and all the complications that can accompany real estate transactions when money is tight?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Was there evidence of that in the record?
Well, there was a contract, a form contract, a sale contract, appended to the development agreement. So if a buyer came in to LaGrange and told Cornell, I want to buy a single-family home, they would sign this form contract, and they would have to get financing themselves. And then the deadlines for Cornell to construct the home under that exhibit to the development agreement, the sale contract, would be self-effectuating based on whether or not the purchaser obtained financing, whether the lot was improved at the point, you know, whether the lot was in fact improved, or whether it had to still be improved. So yes, there were deadlines in an exhibit to the development agreement which contained the form sales contract. And there was a returning to the question about extrinsic evidence. I identified generally where it appeared in our answering brief, where Judge Slights analyzed it in his opinion. What extrinsic evidence does LaGrange have? First, they didn't argue that the contract was ambiguous on appeal. So they didn't bring to bear any evidence, any extrinsic evidence on this appeal that their reading was proper. Why is that? Because in the trial below, the only evidence they attempted to introduce was a question of Mr. Nichols. Mr. Nichols was the LaGrange signatory to the development agreement. He was asked, what does that mean to you? What does that mean to LaGrange, the sales projection schedule? His answer was, well, my banks wouldn't have wanted it any other way. He didn't identify what it meant to LaGrange. He didn't identify how it fit within the constraints of the rest of the development agreement. All he offered was hearsay evidence as to what his banks may have wanted in the development agreement. That's not extrinsic evidence that can help this court construe what projection means. So they don't have any extrinsic evidence, and they haven't presented that argument on appeal. With regard to jumped over my roadmap, but my first point was Judge Slight's, his decision that the contract was unambiguous and it means, projection means an aspiration or a target that should hold. If this court goes to extrinsic evidence, you should find that the weight of the record below shows that the extrinsic evidence comports with my client's reading of the word projection. And Justice Holland asked a question, well, what's the standard of review if we do resort to extrinsic evidence? And Judge Sleights, in his belt and suspenders approach to this decision, weighed factual evidence. And this is Justice Ridgely's decision in the Motorola versus Amcor Tech decision in 2008. Quote, to the extent that the trial court's interpretation of the contract rests upon findings extrinsic to the contract, we defer to the trial court's findings unless those findings are not supported by the record or unless inferences drawn from those findings are not the product of an orderly or logical deductive reasoning process. So you have to defer to a certain extent to Judge Sleight's opinion, his findings, as to what the extrinsic evidence held. We submit, Your Honors, if you go to extrinsic evidence, if you find that there is some ambiguity, whether just in the words sales projection schedule or with regard to how the building provisions, the building permits provision, section 19, paragraph 19, exhibit A, all come together, then when you look at extrinsic evidence, the vast majority, I would submit all the extrinsic evidence, weighs in favor of Cornell's reading. And Justice and Judge Sleights, his factual deduction, his factual reason, deserves some deference, and there is no reason to set it aside.
Well, let's just review how he got there. He denies the motion for summary judgment on the basis that projection is ambiguous. So he's looking for help in defining projection. And then at the end of the trial, he concludes it's unambiguous. The question is, was he simply persuaded by other definitions, which is seems to be your primary argument, or based on what he heard from the parties, did he resolve the definition of the word projection and say, having heard from the parties, it's no longer ambiguous? And so that's my question. What's the basis for changing from ambiguous to unambiguous? Looking at a paper record of some sort or testimony of the parties?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not quite sure I could tell you why Judge Sleights did that, but I could surmise, perhaps, that when he did hear the evidence, when he heard the competing interpretations of what projection meant, it didn't sway him that that he should construe that as a matter of law as ambiguous. On a paper record at summary judgment, he said, well, you know what, I need to know more, I need to see more evidence to see whether or not I'll allow more evidence in saying it's ambiguous to gauge what that term means. But when that other evidence came in, he said, well, I don't find it is ambiguous as a matter of law.
Well, how do you get there without considering extrinsic evidence? And can you do that? If it's either ambiguous or unambiguous on the face of the document, you don't consider extrinsic evidence to reach that conclusion, do you?
No, Your Honor. But on summary judgment, he was provided a limited record. So based on that limited record, he made the legal conclusion that it was ambiguous. I suppose after trial, he looked back at that interim decision and made a final legal decision that it was unambiguous. But even if we were to set that aside, even if we were to say, you know what, maybe Judge Sleights, you know, reversed himself when he shouldn't have, he looked at extrinsic evidence. He did approach not only the analysis of whether it was when it was unambiguous, but he said, even if the court does say that it is ambiguous and I have to look at it extrinsic evidence, the weight of the extrinsic evidence introduced at trial weighs in favor of Cornell's reading.
Well, the purpose of our questions is probably obvious to you, but your more elaborate answer to my question using extrinsic evidence is supported by the cite to Motorola. You go from something that appears to be ambiguous and you resolve the ambiguity by considering extrinsic evidence. But if you simply say, I looked at it on a paper record and I concluded it was ambiguous, now I've looked at it again, I've changed my mind, it's a whole different standard of appellate review. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, Your Honor. It would be de novo with regard to the legal conclusion. To the extent that it was based on factual weighing of extrinsic evidence, there would be some deference, but I would submit either way, Cornell wins.
Yeah, well, your earlier comment about his belt and suspenders approach pretty much says it all, doesn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
He was covering himself for appeal.
Perhaps.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No, Your Honor. I see my time's up. I haven't been able to cover the judicial estoppel. May I have 30 seconds to make a few minor points?
Okay.
With regard to judicial estoppel, there are two reasons why that shouldn't apply. First, the position taken by Cornell below that a default under the development agreement would occur within 5 years is not inconsistent with the position that projection means aspiration or target. And second, as Justice Ridgely also noted in the Motorola decision, not only do you have to have an inconsistent position, but you also have to have reliance by the trial judge. Here, you don't have reliance. You have, on two occasions, Judge Slight saying, I'm not, first of all, he said in the decision, I find that there is some interest in the escrow deed when the escrow agreement was signed. So he says that in one sentence, and then he says, even assuming there was no interest, I don't find that the rule against perpetuities was violated. So, Your Honor, we would submit, Your Honors, we would submit that under the Motorola decision by Justice Ridgely, when you don't have reliance by the trial court, you can't have judicial estoppel.
Thank you. Mr. Inskip, I'll give you a minute and 15 seconds as well of rebuttal on the sole issue of judicial estoppel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I begin with what Cornell said in its brief below on the earlier ruling. LaGrange moved to dismiss Cornell's second complaint on the basis of the rule against perpetuities, that the contract Cornell was asserting could not, by its terms, necessarily either be vested or defeated, the interest thereunder, in any period of time, including 21 years. That's how it was teed up. Cornell said in response to that, the language of the agreement itself as negotiated and agreed by the parties clearly establishes a time frame in which the development was to be complete, and accordingly any claims to the escrow deeds would ripen. Judge Slight's, I won't read all of what Cornell said, I quoted it greater length in the briefs, but in deference to my schedule limitations, the court below adopted that reasoning completely. It said, under the development agreement, the lots must be sold within 11 quarters or 2.75 years from the date of the agreements. It went so far as to say that, quote, if the homes are not sold within the designated period, Cornell is subject to default under the development agreement and corresponding penalties, close quote. That ruling is 180 degrees from the ruling on appeal here that the contractual schedule was merely aspirational.
And thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.